Here is a question which quite naturally many people ask, and it represents a type of question. Does the Mahayana in any way contain a deeper teaching than the Theravada? Well, the answer is very, very simple. There is no such thing as measurement, as comparison in the context of transcendence. You see? Supposing the whole of the Theravada consisted only of the statement Samasati and Samasamadhi will release you out of all bondage forever. Do you think there would have been a great following and a religion founded upon that? And yet, it is a transcendent truth. It would. All presentations are limited expressions of the totality of the transcendent in the context of religion. The context of religion is the transcendent, is the total reality, the whole thing. But any expression perforce is limited. It is suggestive. But because it is an expression that does not deny the transcendent nature of transcendence, it has a relationship to it. There is a line of communication. That line may be a very broad road, or it may be a very narrow path. But it is a line of communication. Now, you can't compare perfection with perfection. This is an absurdity. If one really saw that, one would cease to have any quarrels between the religions. It is because the millions of followers of the different religious formulations are so imperfect and quite often so evil in themselves, so unclean, that's perhaps the best word, that there are quarrels and wars and so forth. You see? But where perfection is concerned, there is no comparison. Where true love is concerned, there is no comparison. Even in our limited worldly sphere, John swears that his sweetheart is the most beautiful girl in the world, and William swears the same about his sweetheart. Let us take it for granted that they are both truly in love, completely in love. They are both swearing the truth. You can't compare John's sweetheart with William's sweetheart. You just can't compare. It's a fool who starts comparing. See, in true love, you have touched the very heart of all beauty. And that beauty and that heart is the immeasurable beauty. The beauty which has no criteria, no standards of evaluation and so forth. So too in the sphere of religion. So too in the sphere of art. I remember I myself arguing with people 50 years ago, oh, Beethoven wrote the greatest symphonies of all. No one wrote symphonies. And a Mozart fan arguing with me, oh, no, not at all. Mozart was the supreme craftsman in symphony writing. And so on and so on. Well, you see, all that was foolishness. If you truly love, if you truly touch the heart of beauty, then one is silent. One is silent and one is in the state of worship, pure worship. So, does the Mahayana in any way contain a deeper teaching than the Theravada? Let the question take leave of you courteously. But it's extraordinary how that sort of thing takes place even with highly intelligent and deeply perceptive people. It's extraordinary. Now, please speak to us on reincarnation. We'll perhaps start off today with some preliminary remarks about it and finish off tomorrow. Here is the Dalai Lama's book, The Opening of the Wisdom Eye. It's a very remarkable book. And I would like to quote what is said in one of the notes, and these notes are very valuable. The Buddhist term Punnabhava, Pali Punnarbhava, Sanskrit, which means literally again becoming, Punna, again, Bhava or Bhava, becoming, again becoming. This literal translation preserves the Buddhist emphasis upon dynamic and changing psychological states, a psychology which operates without reference to hypothetical static entities such as soul, etc. Now note very carefully. The Buddhist emphasis upon dynamic and changing psychological states, a psychology which operates without reference to hypothetical static entities, unchanging, permanent entities. This is the great difference in outlook between popular Hinduism, which talks in terms of my Atma, just as the other religions of the world talk, and religious people talk of my soul, my spirit, and so forth, as if it was my property, and as if it was something permanent, not an entity. but they regard it as an entity. After I'm dead, my soul or spirit will go down below to the warm place or upstairs to the musical place. You see? My soul will do nothing of the sort. It will completely disintegrate with the death of the organism. Completely disappear. How? Why? What we call the existential being, the person whom we contact through our sight, hearing, touch, etc., etc., the senses in the ordinary way, the body, the feelings, the thoughts, the conformations, the character pattern, and discriminative consciousness, they all completely interdepend. Remove any one condition completely, either the shape or form, or the feelings, or the discriminative consciousness, and the whole thing falls to the ground, completely disappears. Can your body continue to live if you took the heart and put it in the cupboard and said, well, I'll use you another day? Don't. Everything functions together. And that's one of the marvelous contributions of Buddhist psychological analysis as regards the constitution of the existential being who, as we see, comes into being, lives and dies. That all these elements are a one togetherness, interdependent, interacting. One is not caused by the other. This is one of the, I think, misleading words. Dr. Konza called it conditioned co-production in connection with the Paticca-samuppada. Dr. Horner uses the phrase conditioned genesis. It is conditional, not in the sense of one is the cause of the other. The whole so-called causative process, the Paticca-samuppada, is presented as starting from avidya as the root cause, and then all the rest comes into being. If avidya is removed, then that is removed, that is removed, that is removed, and each is the cause of the succeeding one. No, that is not the case. They are all completely, the analysis of the thought process is one in which that all 12 elements are interdependent. If we can see that clearly, then we will really understand the Paticca-samuppada. And it is concerned not with a succession of lives. I say this quite positively. It's not concerned with a succession of lives in the reincarnational sense, but it is concerned with your own psychical process, your psychological process. What was the Buddha concerned with? He was a doctor. And the word doctor means teacher also, doctor so and so, you see. Doceo docere, the Latin, I teach, docere to teach. And doctor also means the healer, he who makes whole. What did the Buddha try to make whole or show us how to make whole within ourselves? The body? Nature does that. The mind. The Buddha was the healer of the mind. The way of the Buddha, the way of all the great teachers, was to help each individual person to bring his mind to maturity. Now, mind in itself cannot be brought to maturity because that is a cosmic, archetypal, universal energy. The psyche, which is mind, this universal energy interacting with the particular body, which gives rise to the psychical processes. And that is why psyche, I always say, is rooted in the brain and the nervous system, the activity of the ductus glands and so forth, the electrochemistry of the whole organism. Remove any one of those elements and psyche would vanish. And the human organism would not be there. So now, the whole teaching is directed towards the purification and the complete health of the psyche. This is why the sīlas, the moralities, are of supreme importance in this situation. Because that is the root source of human ill. Craving. Does craving come from my thumbnail or from my curved nose? Where does it come from? Does it come from my bones? Not at all. It's in the psyche. Craving is in the psyche. The body feels hunger. Physical food is taken in. But if I get attached to the pleasant tasting food and gorge myself on it, there'll be a little bit of trouble inside. And certain functionaries within the body will go on strike, quite legitimately in this case. The tummy will rebel, you see, and so forth. But the psyche, which holds this craving, this is the thing to heal. We must clearly understand all these things. Now, he goes on. Reincarnation is a term quite foreign to Buddhist psychology, since it presupposes that which is to incarnate again. It's no good calling it character or anything like that. Character is not an entity. Character is a word with nominal significance, which simply means verbal significance. It's a verbal vapor, if you like. It is the sound we make to represent the usual way in which that man will behave.
I believe it comes from the word engraving.
Engraving?
Yes.
Character?
Yes, engraving. Character,
should you say? Oh, yes. Yes, I see. Thank you. Well now, even rebirth is only used for clarity of expression. And this is where I am not at all in sympathy with that sentence. It's perfectly ridiculous to use rebirth for clarity of expression, because rebirth is understood as reincarnation. It is strongly associated with the word reincarnation. You see? one only finds birth, jati, mentioned in the in the texts. But for depth of meaning, again becoming is much to be preferred. Now, where does this and how does this again becoming take place? It takes place in the lifetime of the whole psychophysical organism. We know that all the cells of the body undergo continuous change right through to the end of life of the organism. We know that all our feelings, thoughts, ideas and so forth and so forth, they all undergo change, continuous change. Right? This change is in accord with the previous state which held good, the previous state of the body and the psyche, the thoughts, the feelings and everything. And this transforms into the next state which emerges out of this state. Now, our consciousness of I am I-ness, I am myself, I am not Mrs. Thatcher or Adolf Hitler or whatever it may be, you see, I'm not that. I am Feroz Mehta. So long as this consciousness persists, it associates itself with the changed state, so that this organism can identify itself as the same organism. You see? It is our own mental passport photograph of ourselves. You get it? Now, the again becoming within the lifetime can be regarded as a rebirth of the I am I consciousness. But the I am I consciousness is only a verbal association. It is not a fact. There is no entity, the I am I consciousness. No, and certainly no permanent entity. It comes into being after you are born. Within the womb, and for some time, a fair time, after you are born, the body is born, there is no I am I consciousness in the separative sense. But because the world around us uses our name and uses other names, by the accumulation of those experiences constantly, then the little one knows I, knows you, knows him, her, it, doggy, pussy, and so on and so on. You see, this, the analytical consciousness comes more and more into operation. Now, we all have self-love. We all desire to continue to live. I don't remember in my childhood ever not wanting to continue to live, except when I got so fed up with things that I felt I'd like to commit suicide. But that was just the usual absurd nonsense which one does go through as a in a petulant state in childhood. See, we cling to life. We definitely cling to life. We want to live and continue to live. And we somehow get the feeling that I must live forever. This I am I consciousness always was. How many of us remember asking our parents, where was I before I was born? There was no I before I was born. Can anybody produce an I before it is born and say that is the I which is going to be born? That is John Smith who is going to be born, or Ram Lal who is going to be born. Be very, I'm sorry if it shatters cherished beliefs. Well, what are we concerned with if we are really religious? Truth or to cling on to our beliefs? This is not an annihilationist presentation. There is no such thing as annihilation. But the transformation which takes place through birth and then the life and what we commonly call death, you see, is a transformation of such a nature into something which we don't know. And truly, we cannot know. When people say that they have developed powers of the mind which enable them to look into somebody else's past lives, I mean, in the reincarnational sense, or to look into their future lives, in the Buddhist texts too. They say, but the Buddha foresaw that so and so would be reborn as so and so, etc. and so on. That is what is stated. Who stated that? The Buddha? He didn't write all that, you know. Other people wrote all that. The Buddha taught Punnabhava, the again becoming here and now in this very life. The Buddha emphasizes that sort of thing very strongly, the again becoming. Now, because we associate our I am I consciousness, our awareness of identity, that I am John Smith, we associate that awareness with the changed condition, that is a rational and reasonable meaning of reincarnation, if you like. This non-entity in fact, but imaginary permanent entity in the minds of people, I am I, is reborn again and again. One of the things that I wanted to say, but of course the time was getting on, I quoted that the Buddha saying, the freedom from the fancy, I am. You see, it's just a false conceit. Now, if we understand this, we will be practical in the religious sense. We'll get on with the job. Here and now. During my lifetime, I expect I'm probably the oldest person in this room at the moment. Anybody more than 77? No. Right. During my lifetime, I've met so many people who can't stomach such an idea. They say, but there must be something immortal. Also, we have our hopes, it doesn't meet with our hopes and our longings for our loved ones to meet them in heaven. For one thing, you might never meet them in heaven. You may go there, but the other... but the loved one may be sent to another place. Somewhat inaccessible. Then what? And if I go to heaven, you see, and so-and-so, who was a thoroughly evil man, as I thought, nevertheless deserved heaven, St. Peter would know all about his records and so forth, and I saw him there, then what? You see, as I said yesterday, truth is a terrible thing. It sears the soul. But we have to be prepared to face it. What I am saying may not be true. As and when I see something which is truer than what I am trying to put before you now, I shall certainly let this go. Absolutely. I won't cling to it. So now, the again becoming is a fact. It's a real fact. Especially in terms of our psychological life. And because this continuous re-becoming again and again is a source of pain and sorrow. Why? Because we try to find satisfaction in any particular state. Satisfaction for ourselves from our limited point of view. Instead of being in tune with life and life's purposes and finding out what they are and then letting our life be ordered by that vision. Therefore, what happens with every becoming? There is an uprising. That uprising is the actual word used, samudaya, and then it proceeds, and then there is a nirodha, a fading away. So we feel, oh dear, that's finished, that's gone. Now what do we do? And we go on with the next state and have the same sort of attitude and the same sort of futile conflict within ourselves, bringing about immense suffering, sorrow, anxiety and all the rest of it. And making ourselves not only a nuisance to ourselves but to our environment, a liability, not an asset to society. So we cling to this belief. Now, all the other religious followings definitely believe in this reincarnation or in a permanent heaven or hell. Well, consider all these things now. Enough has been said at the moment.